Remember the days of dial-up internet? The sound of a modem establishing a connection already belongs to history. And yet, when I first heard it, I was already a working adult, and I'm not exactly ancient now. The sound of a modem is the prime example for me of how our relationship to the past and present is changing. We live in a time where people are staying younger, older, going to Glastonbury and listening to iPods in their 40s and 50s, even older. But in another sense, we're getting older much younger. It is now possible for someone in their 20s to be nostalgic about all sorts of things which no longer surround us, because the pace of change in society is now so fast. In this programme, I'm going to be sharing some of the sounds and recordings which have made an impact on my life, and consider how they illustrate these wider social changes, and also the nature of acoustic memory. There'll be some classic clips later, but first, noises. One of the extraordinary things about sounds is that their familiarity is not simply a matter of how often we hear or have heard them. You hardly ever hear a steam train these days, for example, but everyone recognises the sound when they do. It's an iconic noise that it's hard to imagine us ever forgetting. But what about this one? You probably know what it is, but it's much less recognisable than this. In my lifetime, however, I've heard the first kind of cash till much more than I have the second. Indeed, I used to regularly use one when I worked at a supermarket while in sixth form. Yet the older till, rarely heard in real life by most people under 50, has retained its place in the collective oral memory much better, while the sound of the early electronic tills have been largely forgotten, supplanted by the much more familiar sound of the barcodes being scanned. You see, or rather hear, the same disjunction in many other sounds. Listen to this montage. My bet is that virtually every sound will be instantly recognisable to you, even though you may not have heard any of them for years, or hardly at all, not first-hand at least. You may not have remembered exactly which arcade games the noises came from, but that they were from arcade games was probably immediately evident. But what about this? Even if you got it, it was a credit card being swiped with a manual terminal. It is not, I think, as iconic a sound as many others we rarely hear these days. Or what about this one? That's a manual bus ticket machine, the kind operated with a crank handle. You used to hear it all the time, but since the technology has been superseded, the sound has faded in the collective memory. So why do some sounds live on and others don't? It's not merely a matter of distinctiveness, although for sure that's often part of it. Consider, for example, the sound of an old television coming on. As you press the on switch, there would be a kind of dull thud, and then the transistors would start humming into life. After several seconds, the sound of static crackling across the screen would herald the arrival of the picture. That's a very particular sound sequence which you wouldn't confuse with anything else, And it's also a sound most people heard most days of their lives until not so long ago. Yet it's not the kind of noise which one spontaneously remembers, as we do milk floats, cash registers, and old-fashioned phone rings. I've got a fat BBC catalogue of sound effects here, and you won't find that one in there. So the question remains, why do some sounds endure while others fade away? One suggestion is that certain sounds represent in ways which others do not. That's why the natural way to describe them is as iconic. They are small representations of things we want or have good reason to remember. And that's also why, as sound effects, they often crop up in period dramas. They are as important for evoking the age as any images could be. Steam trains, milk floats, and cash registers represent to us a past we romanticise of friendly train masters, milkmen, and local traders. We may be more ambivalent about our memory of old-fashioned education, but the idea of it has an important role in our collective mythology, and nothing evokes it better than the sound of chalk on board or desks slamming shut. As for the dial-up modem, nobody who remembers the birth of the internet can forget just how amazing it all seemed, and nothing evokes the anticipation of getting online more than the irritating sounds you had to endure before you could do so. Other sounds, although more prevalent, just don't have this representative power. The manual bus ticket machine, the credit card being swiped, the electronic tills that were used before barcode scanning. When these sounds were superseded, we simply moved to an easier technology. The nature of our world didn't change. It is even possible that some sounds are deliberately retained for their representational value. Consider this one. Car manufacturers spend millions trying to make their cars run more quietly, yet in 20-odd years of central locking, if anything, that noise has got louder. It is not too fanciful to suggest that the sound has not been designed out, because it is reassuring, both that the car has indeed been locked, and that you have a sturdy, reliable, secure vehicle. I'd be interested to compare the sounds of different cars being locked. I wouldn't be surprised if the more expensive ones have more solid and reassuring thuds. So the noise of central locking may be with us for a long time for that reason alone. The collective sound memory is also likely to be impoverished by the increasing personalisation of the products we use. So everyone instantly remembers these sounds, for example. But what will these mean to future generations? To those who had these ringtones, they will instantly transport them back in time. But for those who selected or downloaded other ones, they will be meaningless. There are some annoying default ringtones which you hear all the time, particularly on trains it seems, but for many, the only joint recognition will come from very close friends who shared theirs, or random strangers who just happened to have had the same one. As for this tone, it will mean nothing to anyone other than me. That's because, I'm ashamed to say, in a bored moment I used the phone's composer facility to recreate Deep Purple's most famous riff, just for my mobile. At least that one was recognisable. If you know what tune this is meant to be, do email. The customization of sound means that even those we might think of as quasi-eternal may not last much longer. I wouldn't be surprised, for instance, if younger people have to think twice before they remember exactly what this means. Whatever the reason for the fading of some sounds and the endurance of others, it is clear that all sorts of sounds are doomed to die in the collective memory. Which, I wonder, of the noises that define our age or the recent past are going to live, and which will be lost? Of course, many of the most memorable sounds we hear are not the incidental noises of everyday life, but composed music and other recordings. Some of these are personal, recordings we made ourselves, for ourselves. I have only one of these. When I was a teenager, like many people, I liked the idea of being in a band. However, there were two problems. First, I knew it was a pathetic cliché to want such a thing. And second, I couldn't play any instruments. Neither was a terminal problem. My neighbour and I decided to form a kind of ironic group, one that would never perform for others, but would be fun for ourselves. We made just one album, a recording of a live performance on the side of a hill near where we lived, performed to the whole town, or in other words, no one at all, since the unamplified sound didn't carry. I can't find the tape of that historic concert, but I do have the backing tape, which was used to add another all dimension to our four-string acoustic guitar and biscuit tin combo. I played the tape for the first time in decades the other day, having forgotten most of what was on it. The first track is in fact an avant-garde experimental piece of minimalist techno-pop, composed on, I think, an electronic set. Take a listen. What's tragic about that is not that I once made it, but that I still think that if Michael Nyman were to orchestrate it, it could actually be pretty good. Although my foray into composition and performance was short and tongue-in-cheek, like many boys, much of my life was spent with my finger hovering over the record button. I remember our attempts to record off the television with our first tape players. As Bohemian Rhapsody got started on the Christmas Top of the Pops, the voice of my mum calling could be heard rudely intruding, followed by the even clearer, though supposedly whispered, "Shh, we're recording." Records that I played in my youth have fixed themselves in my mind more securely than any sound heard since. For example, when I swim, to alleviate the boredom, I like to listen to albums in my head. The only ones I can recall in enough detail to do this, though, are almost all ones committed to memory in my late teens. When I play Marillion's Clutching at Straws album, for example, the time I spend in the pool corresponds almost exactly to the time elapsed between the start of the record and the part I got to when I get out of the water. Another album I can recall in vivid detail is one of the first I bought, Rainbow's Down to Earth. I remember it arriving in the post as part of a consignment we had ordered from the Pages of Sounds, the now defunct music magazine. I have never replaced the record with a CD, so it's been a few decades since I last heard it. Yet when I replay it in my mind, I seem to have almost total recall. I'm intrigued by the question of how much this is an illusion. When replaying the guitar solo from Eyes of the World, for example, there is certainly enough detail for me to admire Cozy Powell's stupendous drumming. Although these memories are of public objects, each one is deeply personalised, So, for instance, I said I can remember the drumming very clearly, but I'm sure I couldn't reconstruct the bass lines. Memories are also personalised by the exact position of scratches on a record, the anticipation of which would provide a source of repeated tension when listening to old records. On my copy of Deep Purple in Rock, for example, I always dreaded the arrival of this bit of interference. Only when I later bought the CD did I realise that this was not a fault with my vinyl at all, but an integral part of the original recording. CDs also change the listening experience in a curious way. Although the sounds remain the same, their context changes. Most obviously, records no longer have an end of side one and start of side two. Anyone who has become familiar with an album first on vinyl never loses the sense of where sides end and begin, even though there is nothing in the sounds they hear on the CD that tells them this. In a strange way, you hear something that is not there and never had any sound. Endings are also ruined by the inclusion of bonus tracks on CD reissues. On Deep Purple in Rock again, the final track, Hard Loving Man, just has to make the end of the record. The band disintegrates into a frenzy of noises, and only Ritchie Blackmore's guitar is left, no longer playing a series of discernible notes, but breaking up into sounds. It's a breathtaking finale that cannot and must not be followed. But on the CD, it is. Take a listen. Now that is just wrong. The jaunty riff of Black Knight has no right to follow the intensity of Hard Loving Man. Black Knight was a musical afterthought, something the band threw together because the record company couldn't see a single in the experimental album. To tack it onto the end ruins the self-contained majesty of the album. Well, I think so anyway, and I think many would agree. We're moving now from the deeply personal kind of acoustic memory to ones that can be shared, at least by an in-group. But some of the most evocative sound memories are also the most widely shared, and there is little doubt where most examples of these come from. I'm not sure what the cut-off age is exactly, but for anyone my age or older at least, no matter how cultured you are, that is probably one of the most recognisable pieces of music you've ever heard. The theme tune from Black Beauty, first aired in 1972. The music is much more memorable than the programme itself. I can remember the opening credits quite well. Black Beauty is filmed from the air, galloping over green hills. But apart from that, I'm very shaky as to what the programme was about. A period drama like Lassie, but with a horse, is how I can best describe it. For a long time, that was the nature of television. It left a legacy of collective memory because, with only three channels, broadcasting only at certain times, everyone would be aware of almost everything, whether they were devotees of the show or not. Nowhere is this more evident than in the unforgettable catalogue of sporting themes. Imagine what would happen if all these themes were replaced today with tunes that were just as recognisable. In 20 years' time, would people be able to say so easily which sports they were associated with? I doubt it. That's because the nature of television watching has changed, and with it, the nature of our collective sound memory. When I was growing up, television sport was very limited, and it was dominated by the calendar of flagship events. Tournaments came around, and while they were on, you had extensive coverage. That meant that families like mine would watch quite a lot of the Horse of the Year show, for example, even though we had no interest in equestrian sports at any other time of the year. We even watched Crufts. This might sound like a pathetic confession. We were such couch potatoes that we'd watch whatever was put in front of us, whether we found it interesting or not. Well, perhaps there's some truth in that. But a more charitable view is that they were indeed all interesting, at least interesting enough to watch once a year. Now, however, television viewing has become more fragmented. Football fans watch endless football and wouldn't switch over to see Harvey Smith jump the water fence. Cricket fans can spend the whole summer glued to nothing but cricket. With much more choice, there is a sense in which we watch less. Instead of all of us watching a mixture of everything, we each go and binge on our own passions. As a result, we have fewer collective experiences, and we are laying down fewer collective memories. Listen to these theme tunes, for example. I don't recognise most of these, but they are today's equivalents of Black Beauty, Dixon of Dot Green and Dad's Army, top-rated, long-running shows. But as viewing has become more fragmented, so there is less of a collective consciousness to hold these pieces of music. This fragmentation is not just at a time, but over time. Some of my most vivid and fondest oral memories are of comedies, both records and on the radio. My uncle, for example, had a tape of an old Peter Sellers album, which we would play and recite endlessly. It still pains me when I find out there are people living in Britain today who have never heard such classics as Balham, Gateway to the South. I later discovered a friend whose parents had a 10-inch record of this same album, and I, of course, taped it straight away, and still have it.
Balham. Gateway to the South. We enter Balham through the verdant grasslands of Battersea Park, and at once we are aware that here is a land of happy, contented people who go about their daily tasks in truly democratic spirit. This is busy High Street, focal point of the town's activities. Note the quaint old stores whose frontage is covered with hand-painted inscriptions, every one a rare example of native Balham art. Let us read some of them as our camera travels past.
Cooking apples, choice eaters.
A song to remember at the Tandemount Cinema, a
suit to remember at Montague Moss.
Motions conducted with decorum and taste.
Fight tonight. Bring your own paper. Rally Thursday, Berkeley Square. Viscountess Lewisham and Mrs. Gerald Legg. Up the ruling classes.
This shows the manifold activities of Balham's thriving community. But in quiet corners, we still find examples of the exquisite workmanship that Balham craftsmen have made world famous. Toothbrush holesmanship.
On my forge, I carve the little holes in the top of toothbrushes. It is exciting work, and my forefathers have been engaged upon it since 1957. The little holes in the top are put in manually, or in other words, once a year. I recently had the honor of demonstrating my craft before the owner of ours. He stopped by one day for a couple of words. I did not understand either of them.
So much for Balham's Industries. Now let us see a little more of the town. Here is the great park covering nearly half an acre. This is where the children traditionally meet by the limpid waters of the old drinking fountain. A drinking fountain that has for countless years across the vast aeons of time given untold pleasure to man, woman, and child. Beside this fountain, donated by able counselor Quills as long ago as 1928, the little ones sit around a trim nursemaid and listen spellbound and enchanted as she reads them a story.
With one bound, he was by her side. Nora felt his hot breath on her cheek as he ripped the thin silk from...
We are now entering old Balham. Time has passed by this remote corner, so shall we. But Balham is not neglecting the cultural side. This is Eugene Quills, whose weekly recitals are attended by a vast concord of people. He has never had a lesson in his life. Such is the enthusiasm of Balham's music lovers that they are subscribing to a fund to send Eugene to Italy, or Vienna, or anywhere. Night falls on Balham. From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us in a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. The nightlife is awakening. The El Morocco Tea Room.
Hi, miss.
Yes, what you want?
Pilchards.
They're off, dear.
Baked beans?
Off.
Oh, meatloaf salad?
That's off, too.
Pot of tea?
No tea, dear.
Well, just milk, then.
Milk's off.
Rolling butter, then?
No butter, dear.
Oh, just a roll.
Only bread, love.
I might have just as well have stayed at home.
Well, I don't know. It does you good to have a fling occasionally.
And so the long night draws on. The last stragglers make their way home, and the lights go out one by one as dawn approaches and the bell of St. Quill's Parish Church tolls 10 o'clock. Balham sleeps. And so we say farewell to this historic borough with many pleasant memories. And the words of C. Quill Smith, Balham's own bard, burning in our ears.
Broad-bosomed, bold, becalmed, benign, lies Balham, four square, on the northern line. Matched by no marvel save in eastern scene, a rose-red city, half as gold as green. By country churchyard, ferny fen and muir, what Quills mute, inglorious, lies buried here. Oh, stands the church clock at 10 to 3, And is there honey still for tea?
Honey's off, dear.
Balham, Gateway to the South by Peter Sellers. A record like The Best of Sellers binds together the acoustic memories of at least three generations. There I was in the 70s and 80s, listening to a record made in the 50s that was satirising the kind of cinema newsreels that had been made for decades before.
We present Tony Hancock, Sidney James and Bill Kerr in...
Hancock's Half Hour.
Similarly, I remember discovering Tony Hancock via a record of The Blood Donor and the Radio Ham. When we found out that Hancock's Half Hour was being repeated on the radio on Sunday lunchtimes, we set out to capture as many episodes as possible on our then newfangled radio tape recorder. This is a recording I made of my favourite episode of all time, The Poetry Society, where Hancock joins the Bohemian East Cheam Cultural and Progressive Society, or the ECPAS as they are known locally. In this extended clip, his new chums have just arrived at his house in 23 Railway Cuttings for a poetry reading.
Shall we start? We've got many important new works to read.
By all means, I'll get some chairs.
But they won't be necessary. I mean, we don't use chairs. Chairs are a symbol of unproductive work, the furnishings of a decadent society.
Of course, I hadn't realised. Bill, take the chairs out and burn them, horrible suburban bric-a-brac. Well, then, what do we do, then? Stand around?
My dear fellow, haven't you read your handbook? I mean, it definitely states that cultural meetings of the group, such as poetry reading, the members shall adopt postures in keeping with the intellect of the individual without sacrificing the mood of the work. We are thus irrevocably united as a group in relationship to the poem being read.
I see. Well, you start and I'll sort of stand loosely about so I can sort of slide into something as soon as it comes over me, you know.
Yes, well, we'll commence with the work by myself. I have entitled it Tin Can.
Tin Can. Tin Can. Yes, let's see. I think I'll lean up against the fireplace with one arm up, suggesting the lid's been opened.
Oh, blimey, look at him.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please, everyone. I can't get in the mood with talking going on, can I? Right. Tin Can by Gregory. Splish, splash, splonk. Wooden shoes, red socks. Coffins, tombstones, and tranquilizers.
Very good. Very significant.
I hadn't finished, had I?
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Aspirins and driving tests, jet planes and skeletons, frog singing to egg timer, calendars and candles, upside down, plastic apples on coconut trees. Splish, splash, splonk.
Is that it?
Yes, that is it.
They're marvellous. Wish I could write like that. Are you all right? By Jove, you look washed out there.
Well, it's just the emotional strain of reading it. You see, the vibrations sap my energy.
Yes, I know how it is. It's a pity we burnt the chairs. We could have had a nice sit-down.
Did you like the poem?
Like it? It was sensational. What an emotional experience. I haven't heard anything like that since The Road to Mandalay. Who's next?
Rupert.
Oh, we haven't got another one. Bill, let's get the booze out.
Do you mind? If you can't appreciate the delicacy of the works, you might at least have the courtesy to keep your cake hole closed. Bill, what are you doing?
I've adopted a pose in readiness for the next one.
Very funny. Now, come out the sideboard before I clout you one. Right, now, carry on, Rupert.
My piece is rather more spiritual. It's an outcry from the soul of my grandfather. This poem I'm sending to UNESCO for translation into 84 different languages. But for the purposes of this reading, I shall render it in the original English.
If it's anything like the other one, it won't really matter.
Do we have to have this troglodyte here?
What does he mean?
Hit him, Sid.
No, don't, please. This is my first at-home evening. Don't spoil it, please.
Punch his nose in.
I'll punch yours in if you don't keep quiet. This is a cultural evening. We're having no bounce-ups in here.
Oh, for goodness sake, be quiet. All this quarrelling is interfering with my perceptive aura.
You see, you've upset Greta now. Her perceptive aura's gone for a burp. Can be very nasty, too, that can. Now, keep quiet and listen to Rupert.
I've called this poem Blank Details.
Ah, yes. Blank Details, yes. Let's see now. I feel a sort of purple mood coming over me. I think for this I shall sit cross-legged on the floor, yogi style, with one foot tucked behind my neck. Hang on a minute. Hang on, right. Hang on a sec. Right, I'm in. Proceed.
Blank Detail by Rupert. Straw in the wind. 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 Fly, fly, fly.
Marvellous.
Can I read my poem now?
Pardon?
I've just written a poem. Can I read it?
I somehow don't think the sort of poems you write will be suitable for this gathering. We are not interested in young ladies from various parts of the country.
Oh, no, no, I've written an abstract poem.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. One has to be sympathetic with the symbolism of existence to turn out that sort of stuff. Get back on the sideboard.
Oh, no, let's hear what the little savage has written. It might provide some light relief after the intensity of the last two offerings.
Oh, very well. Make it quick and keep it clean.
Thank you. Incandescent by William. Hick, hack, hawk. Rinky, tinky on purple grass. Shafts of light. Hobnailed boots tramping down the bamboo that grows upwards, downwards, sideways into the concrete cosmos. Life is mauve. I am orange. Hick, hack, hawk.
Tony Hancock's The Poetry Society. What strikes me now about my acquisition of cultural gems such as Hancock and Sellers is that both were already very old when I came to them, yet they found their way to me quite naturally. It's all to do with lack of choice again. Now, if you want an old radio or television series, you go out and buy the CDs or DVD boxed sets. Then, most vanished into the ether, but the cream of the crop would be repeated on major channels every now and again. For instance, I've never had videotapes or DVDs of this, but I feel like I know it almost word for word.
If you'd care to sit over there.
Thank you.
Good evening. Good evening. Is your room to your liking?
Yes, it's very nice.
Very nice, thank you.
Oh, good.
I'll just get you tonight's menu. Oh, would you care for a drink before your meal?
A scotch and one and a screwdriver, please.
And for you, madam?
The screwdriver's for me.
I see. Would you like it now or after a meal?
Oh, now, please.
There's nothing I can put right?
What?
Absolutely, sir. It's one scotch and a screwdriver.
I think I'll join you. Make that two screwdrivers, would you?
You'd like a screwdriver as well?
Got it.
So it's one scotch, and you each need a screwdriver.
No. Forget the scotch, two screwdrivers.
I understand, and you'll leave the drinks.
What?
Nothing to drink?
What do you mean, nothing to drink?
Well, you can't drink your screwdrivers, can you?
What else would you suggest that we do with them?
Vodka and orange juice.
Oh, certainly, madam.
Make that two and forget about the screwdrivers.
You sure?
You can manage without them.
As you wish.
Relax in the carefree atmosphere of old English charm. When you are there... I hope we're not intruding on your dinner hour.
Oh, not at all, no. You're American.
That's right.
Where are you from?
California.
Oh, how lovely. You're English, though.
Yes, but I've been over there 10 years now.
10 years? Do you ever get homesick?
Oh, yes, but I love it there. The climate's so wonderful. You can swim and sunbathe and then, after lunch, drive up into the mountains and ski.
How wonderful.
I like England and the English people, but I sure couldn't take this climate.
Harry finds it too gloomy.
Oh, I don't find it too gloomy, do you, Sybil?
Yes, I do, Basil.
Oh, yes, my wife finds it too gloomy. I find it rather bracing.
What do you find bracing, Basil? The damp, the drizzle, the fog?
Well, it's not always like this, dear. It changes.
My husband's like the climate. He changes. This morning he went on for 2 hours about the bloody weather.
Yes, but it has been unusually damp this week, in fact, but normally we're rather spoiled down here on the English Riviera.
Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton were telling me about California. You can swim in the morning and then in the afternoon you can drive up into the mountains and ski.
Must be rather tiring.
Well, one has a choice.
Yes, well, I don't think it would suit me. I rather like it down here. It's very mild all the year round. We have palm trees here in Torquay, you know. Do you have palm trees in California?
Bert Lancaster had one, they say, but I don't believe him. What the hell is that?
Vodka and orange juice.
Orange juice.
I'm afraid it's not fresh.
Isn't it?
No.
We've just opened the bottle.
Look, fresh means it comes out of an orange, not out of a bottle.
Ah, you'd like freshly squeezed orange juice.
As opposed to freshly unscrewed orange juice, yes.
Leave it to me. I mean, I'll get Chef onto it straight away.
Sorry about that. A lot of English people are used to the flavour of the bottle.
Oh, it's all right. It's just that back home, fresh orange juice comes like running water.
Does it really? Of course, it's so good for your skin, isn't it? I'd love to go to California someday. Looks so exciting.
Oh, never love a stranger. Do you like it?
Oh, I love all Harold Robbins. I've read this one 3 times.
The Pirates is his best, I think. I read them when Harry's away. I just don't seem to have the time when he's home.
Who needs Harold Robbins when you've got the real thing?
How long have you been married, Mrs. Forty?
Oh, since 1485.
There we are, fresh orange juice.
Thank you.
Seriously, though, his men are all so interesting. Ruthless and sexy and powerful.
Who's this then, dear? Proust, E.M. Forster?
Harold Robbins.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. My wife likes Harold Robbins. After a hard day slaving under the hairdryer, she needs to unwind with a few aimless thrills. Have you ever read any? Oh, really is the most awful American, well, not American, transatlantic tripe, sort of pornographic Muzak. Still keeps my wife off the streets.
We both like him.
Oh, Robbins.
What?
Harold Robbins. Oh, I thought you meant that awful man. What's his name? Harold Robinson. Have you read any Harold Robinson? Oh, painful.
Oh. How about Waldorf Salad?
Was that one? Yes, you're absolutely right. Oh, that was a shock, wasn't it?
Could you make me a Waldorf salad?
Waldorf
salad.
Well, I think we're just out of Waldorf.
Classic 40 Towers there. The regular repeating of the very best of radio and television meant there was a cumulative heritage which was passed down the generations. I'm sure we're going to see less of that in the future. Paradoxically, the more available classics are, the less they seem to stick in our memories. Whereas I used to rejoice at every repeat of 40 Towers and make a date to watch it, now I can view it any time I like. I can't remember the last time I actually did. I also watch much less of The Simpsons since I acquired several box sets. This also means that whereas I enjoyed these programmes with my parents' generation, such crossover is now less likely. With the average home now containing 3 television sets, the days when everyone would commune around the same programmes have gone. This is another respect in which present trends contradict each other. On the one hand, generational boundaries are breaking down, and we are told that parents are more likely to be into the same music as their children. But the loss of the communal act of listening to the radio or watching TV means that these media are less shared than they used to be. Comedy classics also have another contradictory feature. They are timeless, yet also so much of their time. The comedies that don't last fail to achieve this paradoxical blend. I suspect that many extremely popular programmes like The Fast Show and Little Britain will go the way of Rings on Their Fingers and George and Mildred, rating toppers in their day, but now largely forgotten. This isn't just a question of quality. Consider, for example, the Radio 4 series The Sunday Format, an audio spoof of the Sunday papers.
Yeah, I like it when they've got all those articles about good-looking blokes.
I suppose it's like a very good wine.
I can't imagine what I did without it, really.
Interviews, definitely.
Jenny Murray.
It's very dry, and I like that.
I think it's a question of voice.
It's good we're wasting time on a Sunday.
The colours are nice.
Miserable rich people, I like reading about them.
I think what I like about it is it lets you come towards it rather than it letting... rather than you... You know, instead of it going... It's really very good.
Contents page.
Cover story.
How getting better can make you ill. Page 34.
How getting ill can make you better. Page 35.
Milk of magnesia. An old-fashioned, ineffectual remedy. But can it bring back the dead? Dr. Rubens thinks so. Page 36.
Page 12. The Big C. At last, a cure for dyslexia.
Andrew's liver salts. An old-fashioned, ineffectual remedy. But can it cure terminal cancer? Dr. Rubenstein thinks so.
Is death really that bad? Page 34.
Doctors. Are they curing us to death? Page 36.
Sections of the Sunday format are carefully collated at our print centres and newsagents. If any section of your Sunday format is missing, do please let us know and we will try to trace it for you.
Happy childhoods, the new taboo?
Dr. Claire Pidgeon argues that happy childhoods are nothing to be ashamed of.
New research last week confirmed what we've all suspected. More people have had happy childhoods than previously thought possible. Yet why are so few of us able to come forward? Clearly, it's something of a taboo. Nowadays, no one wants to go to a dinner party only to be confronted with the smiling face of someone giving a blow-by-blow account of a pleasant visit to the zoo with their caring stepfather. It takes courage to admit that you enjoyed camping holidays in France and that your own father put a banana under his nose, pretended it was a moustache, and it made you laugh.
10 essential luxury items.
Swiss chocolates.
A personal masseur.
A cafetiere for every room.
A silk pillowcase travel case.
A house in Stratford-upon-Avon.
A season ticket to Manchester United.
A fork made of gold.
A yacht.
A second yacht.
A third car.
Plastic surgery.
A butler.
10 things to take to the gym.
I have developed my own recovered memory class, which helps us come to terms with the happy memories which many of us suppress. One patient of mine demanded I uncover some nasty stuff which would help to explain his unhappy life. But instead, we recovered memories of fishing, chasing butterflies, and helping Dad make shelves in his workshop. My patient was devastated because he could no longer blame his parents for his messed up life. But he is now on long-term medication, and I'm sure he'll pull through.
The fast edit, rapid-fire nature of the Sunday format immediately reveals it to be a product of the noughties. That clip was just 2.5 minutes long, yet it crammed in so much. We can recognise the kind of journalism that satirises very easily, but would it make sense to listeners in 10 years or so? It's hard to say. Yes Minister, for example, was highly topical. Yet watching the programme today, it is incredible how many of the issues have simply recurred, suggesting that although a week is a long time in politics, 3 decades is no time at all. A recent comedian who has managed to somehow transcend generations and geography is Graham Fellows, creator of John Shuttleworth. Like Peter Sellers, Fellows creates all the voices and characters himself. But the motif of one man hovering over the record button is both the reality behind the characters and the conceit at the heart of the comedy itself. John Shuttleworth is a character for our time, yet he comes from quite another. He also manages to be both universally recognisable and very much a product of his native South Yorkshire. Here he is, recording his low-tech radio shows as usual, while on a mini-break in Giggleswick, where he has been joined by his neighbour and sole agent, Ken Worthington.
Episode 2, Mini Break in Giggleswick.
I'm surprised you found us, actually.
What do you mean?
After last week's fiasco.
Oh, yes.
Yes, because we went round and round in circles looking for that recording studio, ladies and gentlemen. We couldn't find it.
No. It's been converted into a craft centre, hasn't it?
That's right. Mm. They did very nice chocolate brownies.
They did.
Filter coffee, you know. Mm. Which made up for the disappointment of not cutting a disc.
Oh, I'm sorry, John.
Doesn't matter, Ken.
Mm. Another time.
Yeah. It's quite gloomy, isn't it?
Mm. It is.
Lots of grey clouds in the sky. It's almost as if God has cleansed his face with cotton wool.
Mm.
And then thrown the residue into the sky.
Oh, nice image.
Do you like it?
Nice image, that.
Yeah, just thought of it.
Oh.
In fact, looks like it's going to rain, Ken.
Yes, it does.
I suggest we get into your Toyota and, you know, find a nice
pub.
Tea room.
Oh,
pub, yes. Yes. Right. I'll have a lager with you, Ken. Mm. Yes, it'll be nice.
Go down on your knee to the honeybee, for she is very nice. Before you kill her with a rolled up mirror, think twice. How will that bee's mother feel when she finds out her child is a ghost? Kill the bee, and ultimately you'll have nothing to spread on your toast.
Yes, indeed. That was The Bee and the Wasp, a song which I wrote for my son Darren after I caught him swatting honeybees in the bay window of our lounge last summer. And he claimed that they were jaspers, but they weren't. They were honeybees. And I wrote that to instruct him, you know, put him right.
Jan.
But
Jan, love, can I unplug this organ now, please, because I want to blow up.
Yes. Yes, you can, Mary.
Right, thank you.
Is that sachet of hot chocolate still available?
I have no idea.
Because ideally I'd like that.
Yes, it is. Do you want it?
Unless you want it.
No, I don't want it, no. You can have it.
Right, okay. Thank you.
Do you want a shortbread biscuit as well?
No. No, thanks. I'm a little bit full.
Right.
Where's Karen?
I believe she's playing ping pong with Ken.
Is she? Oh, in the lounge. I thought that Swiss couple were going to be on it all night, actually. Yeah, we're in the guest house. Just had a lovely dinner. Nice trout.
Mm, it's lovely, wasn't it?
Hey, I don't like that lady. Do you, Mary?
Which one?
Our landlady.
Oh, no.
She's got very short hair. And she's got like a kilt, isn't it? Very thick tartan skirt.
Yeah, it's a skirt, it's not
and,
a kilt.
She rushes around dead quickly, frightening everybody, you know. It's terrible.
Mm.
But we've got a lager from the bar, which is nice, you know. We're on holiday, and it feels like we're on holiday, which is the main thing, you know.
Does it? Might do to you, doesn't to me.
Doesn't to love.
No, it doesn't.
I'm sorry.
I mean, maybe if you switch this tape off, we could start enjoying ourselves. It just seems to dominate, doesn't it?
No.
I mean, people aren't going to be interested in this, are they?
Do you not think so?
No, they're not going to want to listen to this. It's boring.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'll switch it off then.
Good.
Yeah. Bye for now.
Yeah!
2013.
15?
It's 13, Ken. Don't cheat.
Stop cheating, Ken.
Oh, I could have sworn it was 15. Because I did that clever looping shot, didn't I?
Yeah, and you were on 12 then.
Oh.
Play on 2013.
Does this mean it's match point then?
It does, I'm afraid, yes.
Oh, got my work cut out then, haven't I? Oh, sorry. It's gone in your drink.
Ken.
What is that,
Chilling? Blinking idiot.
Hey, what is it?
Marguerite.
Thanks, Ken.
Margarita.
Ooh, can I have some?
No.
Go on, just a little sip.
No, you're going to be too drunk to drive.
No, I'm not.
What have you had tonight?
I've had very little.
You're a very silly man.
Thank you.
Part of an episode of The Shuttleworths. There is still plenty of comedy which creates bridges between past and present and across generations. But overall, I think the way that we live now is changing our relationship to the past and to other generations. And nowhere is this more evident than in our shared, or not, experience of the sounds around us. Today, our most shared experiences of sound are probably not songs, radio programmes or TV themes, but things like this. As we go around in our own bubbles, literally or metaphorically in a private world of our own headphones, increasingly the sounds we share with others are simply oral leakage, the music coming from a fellow passenger's iPod or family member's bedroom, or the conversation overheard from people talking too loudly into their mobiles. For future generations, there will be fewer opportunities to hear something from the past that will instantly bond them with others of the same age. In the future, all the nostalgia will sound like this.
The number you have dialed has not been recognised. Please check and try again.
Which just shows that nostalgia won't be what it will have used to have been, because for me, and many others, it still, thankfully, sounds like this.
The Archive R was presented by Julian Baggini and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. After the news, the first part of our new classic serial, The Worst Journey in the World by Apsley Cherry Garrard, adapted by the award-winning novelist Steph Penny. Cherry was the youngest member of Captain Scott's ill-fated expedition team to the Antarctic, and the heroic story becomes a study of the psychology of failure as the young explorers battle against harsh weather, poor equipment, and worst of all, the consequences of bad decisions. The classic serial begins in a couple of minutes.
Dirk Gently, Solistic Detective Agency.
You don't look like a private detective.
Gently, where are you?
Harry Enfield returns as Douglas Adams's Holistic Detective.
I've never been bothered by superstition. Touch wood.
Who's fallen on hard times.
Cross my palm with a pound coin and I'll reveal your future.
Also starring Peter Davison.
Feel free to give me a BMW Roadster.
And Stephen Moore as the god Odin.
It is parked outside.
The long, dark tea time of the soul.
Now, this is interesting.
Is on BBC Radio 4.
Any time of day, I'll be there.
Next Thursday evening at 11.
I'll set the radio alarm.
And you can meet the cast and catch up with the background to the new series of Dirk Gently at the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.